Raised Sports is a proud member of the Storyhanger Podcast Network. For more information, go to storyhanger.com.
When he drove off the cliff and I went to visit him at the hospital, I knew something was wrong because his pupils were different. And I asked him, "What's wrong? What's wrong? What's going on?" And he's like, "Nothing, nothing." And then that's when he, I guess his life he just gave up.
For decades now, football has been America's favorite sport. We love its athleticism, its speed, its grace, and if we're being honest, we also love its violence and its brutality.
He hasn't moved since he took that hit.
The players are modern-day gladiators, sacrificing their bodies for every yard of Coliseum turf.
Once again, a violent collision. This one's head-to-head.
They get dinged up, they get their bells rung, and then they shake it off and get back out there, all for our entertainment.
Are you not entertained?
But it is becoming increasingly apparent that there is a price to be paid for this entertainment, long-term effects that can dramatically impact the lives of both the athletes and their loved ones.
People need to know that the human brain is a post-mitotic organ. It doesn't have any reasonable capacity to cure itself of injuries.
Welcome to Season 1 of the Raised Sports Podcast, in which we'll tackle the issue of concussions and CTE, brain trauma in the sport of football.
They took a vicious hit. He's still down, hasn't moved.
What does it all mean for the health of the athletes, these modern-day gladiators?
I don't know how you take this out of the game of football. I don't know if there's anything you can do.
And how will our growing knowledge of the issue impact the future of the sport itself? In the long run, is it all worth it?
Atwater just killed Randy Hilliard.
Episode 3, There's Something Wrong with Junior. The date was May 2nd, 2012. The sports world was rocked. A football legend dead.
Good evening. He was a big name in the world of sports.
A star linebacker known for hard hits.
Junior Seau has been found dead.
The 43-year-old was found wounded with a pistol by his side.
Police in Oceanside, California confirmed the death Wednesday.
This case, at this point, is being investigated as a suicide.
The San Diego Medical Examiner confirmed what investigators already believed.
Confirmed Seau's death as suicide.
Seau has had a troubled life after retiring in 2009.
He survived a 100-foot plunge down a cliff in his SUV.
Seau told police he had fallen asleep at the wheel.
Did a lifetime of football and hard hits affect Seau's mental health?
His name now joins a growing sad list of players who have found their post-game years filled with too much pain to go on.
It was all over the news, ABC, Fox, NBC, national, local, everywhere. The death of Junior Seau was shocking on so many levels. He was so young, just 43, one of the greatest linebackers in the history of the NFL, rose to stardom in San Diego, the city he loved. He seemingly had it all, and yet he gave it all up, pressing a gun against his chest and pulling the trigger. Even more puzzling, the cause of death did not match the public persona. Seau was this strong, tough guy, a wrecking ball of a football player for 20 years in the NFL. And he was also this effervescent, charismatic guy who was full of energy. He was a leader on the field and a pillar of the San Diego community, especially in nearby Oceanside where he grew up. And everywhere he went, he was always smiling. From the outside, and even to many on the inside, none of this made any sense. Chargers quarterback Stan Humphries kind of seemed to speak for everyone around the league when he said he was just shocked. General manager Bobby Bethard, the man who drafted Seau, said he just couldn't imagine this. He said, "I've never seen Junior in a down frame of mind." And even Junior's mother Louisa pleaded in an emotional public statement, "I don't understand." The sports world was stunned, but should it have been? Junior's sister, Mary, isn't so sure. She carries the evidence on her phone wherever she goes. It's a clip from an interview Junior did with reporter Jim Trotter, just shortly before the suicide. Mary shared the clip with me. Here it is.
No source thinks that the game has changed for the worse. They don't have a father that can remember his name because of the game. Everybody had to wake up with their dad, not knowing his name, not knowing his kid's name, being able to function, you know, at a normal rate. I mean, they will understand that, you know, the game needs to change.
If everybody had to wake up with their dad not knowing his name, they'd understand that the game needs to change.
And just listening to his tone of voice, because I know him, he was crying out for help, and nobody caught it.
That's Mary Seau, and this is her story. She believes somebody should have noticed. She says Junior's friends in his post-playing days, the guys hanging out with him, partying with him, should have done something. They should have helped him.
I blame the people that was always with him. If you say you knew him, then why didn't you help him out? Because all these people that I felt like Junior had trusted, that had been with him before this interview, you should have helped him help him out. And then after the interview, when I listened to the interview, and I keep, you know, and I'm right away when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, my brother is hurting. He's crying for help. What are you people doing? He's on the radio. He's crying for help.
Of course, nothing is that simple. And as you'll see, Mary has placed quite a bit of guilt on her own shoulders as well. Taina Seau was a school custodian in Oceanside, California, a hard neighborhood just up Interstate 5 from San Diego and butting up against the southern border of Camp Pendleton. His wife, Louisa, worked in the commissary there. They were hard workers and raised a family that loved its faith, its music, and especially its sports. David was the oldest child, then came Mary, Savai, and Annette, followed by Taina Jr., or simply Junior, June, or Junebug. A sixth child, Tony, arrived later when Junior was 8 years old. With both parents working, the Seau kids kept themselves busy. They played all sorts of sports and invented games and activities for themselves all around their neighborhood.
We made our own, what we call flag football band. And the boys in the neighborhood made their own go-kart. They got the lumber from my dad's lumber in the backyard, and the homeless people would steal carts and then go in the canyon and take the wheels off the cart, and they would build a go-kart. And my dad would come home, get upset and asking, you know, who's been taking the lumber? So my dad had to build a hut and lock his wood to make sure nobody was taking the lumber. But by that time, the boys had already made four go-karts. And the go-karts were hidden at our next door neighbor's house. So that way my dad wouldn't see or know.
Junior was irrepressible and supremely competitive from a very young age. He looked up to his older siblings, but he also kind of wanted to beat them all at everything. When they would run these neighborhood relay races around the block, Junior insisted on running the anchor leg because he had figured out pretty quickly that the anchor leg runner was the one that got the glory at the finish line. There's a great story. At one point, a neighbor registered a complaint to the Seau family. It seems they were being awakened at 6 o'clock in the morning by somebody outside their house playing on their basketball hoop. Turned out it was Junior, who was about 8 years old at the time. The complaints didn't make Dad happy, but the complaints continued because Junior just refused to stop. Eventually, it was the neighbors who bent to his will and just moved their basketball hoop away from the house out into the street so that Junior could play basketball and they could get some sleep. As often is the case in a large family, especially when both parents are working, the oldest daughter can kind of become a mother-like figure to the others. And that was Mary. She was in charge of Junior, and it wasn't the easiest job.
I used to always get in trouble because in the summer, when my parents came home, they were always looking for Junior. And when Junior's nowhere around the house, and my mom's like, they called him Pepe because he was at that time the youngest in the family. Mm-hmm. And they'll come home and say, where's Pepe at? And And we're looking at each other like, where is he? And he's at another next door neighbor's house just hanging out and playing basketball either in the backyard of their house or playing some kind of football or tag football, but he's always somewhere in the neighborhood playing.
The two developed a bond, and Junior often came to Mary for advice. She was the one that got him his first library card. She was the one who helped him join the school's reading club. She steered him towards sports books because she figured that was probably the only way to get him interested in reading. And as an athlete herself, she helped him out with sports too. She helped teach him a sprinting technique to help him run faster. She'd play catch with him, and she even attempted to do some workouts with him. She also had to teach him humility, and that wasn't necessarily the easiest thing to do when you're dealing with someone so confident. In his very first track meet, Mary told Junior to shake hands with the runners he had just beaten and to thank his coaches, but he embarrassed her by refusing to do so. But in the second meet, Mary says he did just what she'd asked. So while the competitiveness and confidence came naturally to Junior, finding that humility took a little bit of work.
We were in his room, and we were just talking. He was tossing his basketball up in the air. And he told me, you know what, I'm going to do better than all my brothers and sisters. And I said, you know what, you are going to be better than all of us, but you need to be humble about it. Don't go around telling people that you're better than all these other people, especially your siblings, because then you're not going to be humble.
Junior also had a temper, a trait that never quite left him, even as he matured and grew older. In fact, in his very first NFL game, which was just a preseason game against the Raiders, meaning very little in the grand scheme of things, he actually got himself ejected from the game for getting in an altercation with one of the Raiders linemen. That temper was often simmering beneath the surface, and it would crop up a little bit later in life. Mary, though, says that it was one of those things, it was more about him being hard on himself, being critical of himself, than being directed at opponents or teammates so much.
People mistaken his anger as bad sportsmanship, but it wasn't that he was angry at anybody. He was angry at himself because he could never beat himself. He always said that he sucked. He always has to beat himself up.
Through grade school, middle school, and on into high school, Mary was there to help guide him.
He was my child, I guess. And a lot, when he introduced me to people, his friends, his foundation, he'll introduce me as, this is my second mom, my sister, and everybody that he introduces me, he's like, I had an old sister. I knew you had this sister, but I didn't know this one. And I was, yeah, this is my sister. And now they go, well, she's pretty. What happened to you?
Junior Seau's playing career has been well documented. 20 years in the NFL, 12 consecutive Pro Bowls, more than 1,500 tackles, and who knows how many hits. Countless, countless hits. There were tremendous high points. He led the Chargers to the franchise's only Super Bowl appearance in 1994. But there were low points, too. The Chargers struggled during much of his career there. And they also decided that they were kind of done with him before he was done playing himself. And so Junior finished out his career in Miami and New England. Perhaps an undersold part of Junior's playing career, at least as far as understanding what kind of person he was his absolute refusal to show any weakness or pain. He was legendary for this, for his ability to play through injuries. In Jim Trotter's book, which was called Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon, former teammate Orlando Ruff said of Junior, quote, people always said, does this guy never get hurt? It was just the opposite. He got hurt all the time. But what would make you and I stand down or sit out? That wasn't an option for him. One example of this came in 1997. Junior had suffered a knee injury during the preseason and needed surgery to repair a torn meniscus. He was expected to miss 6 weeks, but after the Chargers got blown out in their season opener, Junior was right back on the field for week two. He had 11 tackles, a sack, he forced one fumble and recovered another, and the Chargers beat the New Orleans Saints that day. As an NFL player, Junior Seau was still that unstoppable boy from Oceanside. Always full of energy, happy, positive, always refusing to acknowledge weakness, pain, or any kind of obstacle that might get in his way. But towards the end of his career, troubling signs started to crop up, and they got worse after he finally hung up his cleats in January of 2010. Always so careful with money, Junior started to show signs of a gambling addiction, taking high roller trips to Las Vegas with these friends of his. He had odd flashes of anger and irrational behavior. There was one story where he came in and fired the entire staff of his restaurant, which was called Seau's, and then he just hired them all back the next day. He also had problems maintaining personal relationships, and over time he grew more and more distant from his children. The public veneer was showing some cracks. And then on October 18th, 2010, Junior drove his car off a cliff.
He survived a 100-foot plunge down a cliff in his SUV just hours after his arrest for investigation of domestic violence. Seau said he fell asleep at the wheel.
The previous night, Junior had been arrested for domestic assault against Mary Nolan, his girlfriend at the time. After being released from jail, he went for a drive, distraught. His car veered off the edge of the road and went 100 feet down towards the beach below. There were rumblings that the crash had been a suicide attempt, but he publicly denied it. There were so many signs of trouble, and yet nothing happened. Nobody noticed, or if they did, they either couldn't reach him or didn't bother to try. As noted earlier, Mary places a lot of blame on Junior's partying buddies, and she's not alone. Here's what former teammate Rodney Harrison had to say about it in Jim Trotter's book. Quote, "There were a lot of people around Junior that knew Junior was going through certain things, but they didn't care. They cared about Junior because he gave them something. He gave them a sense of importance, a good time. I'm hanging out with Junior Seau. The people close to him who say they didn't see the signs, you've got to be joking. You've got to be kidding me. I didn't even hang out with Junior and I could see the signs. I could see the depression. I tried to reach out to Junior and that's the problem. He surrounded himself with people that..." Harrison didn't finish his sentence, and he didn't really need to. Mary shares that sentiment, but there is something more upsetting to her than the inaction of Junior's friends. You see, when they were younger, as we talked about, she had been like a second mother to Junior, a person he would often come to for guidance. And in this case, he also came to her for help, though he did it in a roundabout way and without actually admitting he needed any help.
A year or maybe 2 years before his death, he did ask me, "Hey, sis, how about you helping me out and try to find some questions about young kids' brain?" I go, What do you mean? What's going on?" And I just need more information about the youth brain. And I like, what are you looking for? What are you asking me to do?" And he goes, "Just do it for me." And I'm like, "Okay, whatever." And we hung up and I go, "I'm not going to do it."
In hindsight, it's fairly clear what he was asking. But in the moment, Mary just didn't see it. She didn't take her brother seriously. She didn't read between the lines and figure out what he was driving at. She laughed it off, and it haunts her to this very day.
He wasn't very clear exactly what, you know, what this youth brain had to do. I mean, I have to have more information. Like, if he would have told me, "The reason why I need you to check on youth brain is because something's wrong with me." But yes, I think that if I would have listened to him and done it, and then that would have opened my eyes exactly like, okay, if I'm doing this, there's something wrong with Junior. And if I would have informed him and educated what my findings were, he would ask me more questions. And maybe we could have worked together on this to understand more about his illness.
Junior asked me a question.
And if I would have listened to him and not laughed. I would understand what he was going through. And maybe I could have helped him out. He always came to me. And I failed.
The thing is, Junior knew his behavior was out of control. He was aware that he was being used by these people he called friends. He knew he needed to change, and he knew that he needed to get help. And we know all of this because he kept a journal and he wrote about all of it. But the things he wrote down, he just could not get himself to say them to anyone who truly cared about him. In ESPN's 30 for 30 documentary on Seau, Junior's son Jake, in a particularly emotional portion of the film, reads from the journal, and he recites such lines as, "The longer I'm alone, the more I push away. I am hurting a lot of people around me, and it's not cool." And then there's this one. "This world has nothing for me." Then Jake says, "It's frustrating that he can write these things, you know? Things that I wanted to address with him, and that he can write them out, but he couldn't do anything about. That's frustrating to me." And then Jake pauses and he says, "The hardest part is, this world has nothing for me. You know, he had us." But Junior distanced himself from those who loved him most. In the rare moments he did open up and show vulnerability, it was only briefly and often in coded language. He couldn't bring himself to show weakness. He remained insistent on being a giver, not a taker, insisted on being the rock of his family. He insisted on running that anchor leg. Junior's death was devastating to his family and his friends, and while tests on his brain showed he had been suffering from the degenerative brain disease CTE, that offered little relief. It just made loved ones wish they had done more to help him. How does one move forward after that? For Mary, it's about sharing her experience and her knowledge about everything she's learned in the wake of her brother's death. She launched the Mary Seau CTE Foundation, which aims to raise money to help fund research into the long-term effects of repetitive head impacts. Last spring, she held her first fundraiser, and it was headlined by Chris Nowinski, a former Harvard football player who is among the most high-profile advocates for CTE research in the country. And she's working to spread awareness and education to young athletes and their parents. She doesn't tell people what to do. That's just not her nature. And growing up with a sporting family, she understands why people love football. She just tries to share what she knows about repetitive head hits and what they can do to the human brain. Then let people decide for themselves.
I cannot tell these parents what to do and how to take care of their kids. But I can give them the awareness. This is how your brain functions work. This is what brain injury and brain trauma means.
And Mary practices what she preaches. Her own son, Ian, was a very good football player, a star defensive lineman at the University of Nevada. He was not drafted and has not made an NFL roster to date, though he has gotten some looks from the Los Angeles Rams, the Buffalo Bills, and the New York Giants. Mary says they don't talk about whether or not his football dream is over yet. It worries her, but she at least is glad to know that he is completely aware of the risks.
Ian knew how I felt, that I still supported him. Because the reason why is because I didn't want him to look back when he's older and say, "Oh, I couldn't play football because my mom didn't want me to." I didn't want him to be unhappy for the rest of his life. I wanted him to be the man who he is and experience life in experience what he can. So he did experience the NFL life. I'm not sure if it's over with, because I don't talk about it, but it's his life. I don't want to hold him back. He is aware, and you know, we talked about it. He goes, "Mom, I already know. Because literally we sat down and we did our research, and we were all in an awe, because we didn't know. We didn't know how bad it is.
Thank you for listening to the Raised Sports Podcast. For more on this topic, go to raisedsports.com. And to learn more about Mary Sayow's foundation, go to msctefoundation.org. There you can learn more about the foundation's mission, you can find out ways to help, and you can even purchase tickets to the next fundraiser, which is coming up on March 31st in San Diego. This episode was written and produced by me, Bob Harkins. Special thanks for the music, which comes from Sergei Cheremisimov, Philip Weigel, and Kai Engel. The theme song from DL Sounds. If you would like to support our work, join our membership club at patreon.com/raisedsports. By pledging as little as $1 a month, you'll have access to members-only content, have a chance to give feedback on the direction of the show, and be eligible to participate in contests and maybe win some prizes. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.